And the telltale signal in Wirecard was very obvious. It started off at €1 billion in cash, and it raised a 500 million euro bond and a 750 million euro bond. And when it went bust, it had 3 billion in cash in the balance sheet. And you just ask yourself, why would it need that money? There was one reason it needed the money, was that the cash wasn't real.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. For all the narratives around investing and making money, those who've survived the investment cycles for decades and earned above average returns have typically adhered to sound disciplines, valuing companies correctly, not taking shortcuts, not being swayed by management ebullience, and that means digging into the financial statements and knowing what you're looking for, especially red flags. It doesn't sound glamorous or sexy, but making money typically isn't. So in this episode, we've invited a seasoned analyst, investor, author, and podcast host to talk about these skills. So Steve Clapham from Behind the Balance Sheet, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to talk to you.
Steve, most people don't dream of becoming an unforgiving examiner of balance sheets and income statements in a desire to sift the good from the bad. Where did this begin? Is it a product of a Calvinist Scottish upbringing?
No, sadly not. It's completely by accident. My parents, they wanted nothing more than all their children to have a professional background and to have a profession because they perceived that was security. Sadly, none of their four children managed that. But I did train as an accountant, and it was actually an incredibly good discipline. So when I ended up in the city, I actually knew what I was doing. Partly, I knew nothing about valuation, of course, but at least I could read a balance sheet. And that I always played to my strengths.
But accounting, lots of people we know make that transition from accounting to the city. What was it that particularly was the magnet?
It was a complete accident, actually. I'd interviewed for a really high job in one of the UK's largest companies. So I was interviewed by the CFO. I think it was number 5 or 10 in the FTSE 100 at the time. I got the job and I was all excited. And then they called me up and they said, Steve, just one problem here, because we just realized personnel told us that you're too young to be this grade. So don't worry, you're going to be doing exactly the same job, but you'll have a slightly lower salary, but we'll put it up next year and it'll be fine. And I said, hang on a second. I don't think I want to come and work for a company where your age determines your progression. I want to work for a company where your performance determines it. I told them I didn't want the job, but I wasn't really enjoying the job that I was doing. So I thought I better find something else. And somebody said to me, why don't you go in the city? And they introduced me to someone who would help me understand how the city worked. I had no idea. And they said, oh, you know what you're doing. Why don't you come work for us? I went literally, it wasn't a job interview. It was simply a meeting to understand how the city worked and what sort of role. And they said, why don't you become an analyst? So I said, sure.
So there you go. And of course, you've had a very successful career working with a number of financial institutions and clearly teaching and honing your skills and practicing them as an investor, most importantly. We're going to talk about this whole issue of financial literacy. But if I could just ask you to summarize why you started your current business Behind the Balance Sheet and how did you articulate your mission?
The honest answer is I felt I was too old to get a job as a hedge fund analyst because the average hedge fund manager is 42. And as you know, I'm quite a bit older than that. And it just seemed it was the time to make a transition. And I didn't really know what I could do because I've got no skill. I can do one thing quite well, but nothing else. So it had to be something around investing. And somebody came up with the bright idea, why don't you start a training business? So I started off actually doing one-to-one coaching, which I still do a little bit of. And it's really good fun. I really enjoy because you're working with young people and helping them and watching them progress. But then Russell Napier, the famous financial historian, called me up and he said, Stuart investors were looking for somebody to build them a forensic accounting course. And he said, why don't you do it? And I said, well, I'm not sure that I could. And he said, well, we'll have a chat with them. And they said, well, why don't you go off and try this? And I went off to the British Library for about 6 weeks and I studied a whole load of past frauds and I completely blew my budget, you know, because obviously I had a limited amount of time, but I found it so interesting. And I've been doing that forensic accounting course now for over 5 years, and something like 600 people have taken that course. And it's been great fun because you're helping people. And that's really, really enjoyable and really rewarding.
So back to financial literacy, because I was talking to Stephen Zimmerman a couple of weeks ago. And for those who don't know, he and Carol Galli grew and managed Mercury Asset Management into one of the most successful European investment management groups, eventually acquired by Merrill's. And he pointed out that when you joined Mercury as a portfolio manager, you had a 2-year compulsory training program, a bit like Financial National Service. And he asked the question, which I'm now going to pose to you, is that, can you get that today?
Well, I think most people sort of outsource it to the CFA. And I think that's very, very dangerous. Normally, what I do is I go in and train very experienced people. So people with 5 or 10 or even more experience. I've trained several people that manage $10 billion portfolios because I'm doing very specialist thing. But more recently, I've been doing more with younger people. So we've been doing, just today, I was training a couple of people who have got 2 to 3 years experience, who joined the hedge fund. So it's like graduate trainees, but they've got a bit more experience. And the interesting thing is how little they know. It's quite frightening. You know, these are not daft. They're really smart, really bright, really intelligent people. I had exactly the same thing last week. I trained 4 people with between 2 and 3 years experience. And what they don't know is quite scary. And one of these people had done level 2 of a CFA. So she's done 2 years of studying the CFA. And there are still huge gaps in the financial knowledge. And it amazes me, what other profession has no formal training program? Now, I know we've got the CFA, but I don't think the CFA really equips you to be a financial analyst and really equips you to understand the financial statements, which is shocking.
So it is such an interesting conversation because I remember vividly at Morgan Stanley, they like to hire MBAs, although I wasn't one, and they like to then, towards the latter stages, hire CFAs, the Chartered Financial Analyst, because it became this accreditation that was very hard to get and in some way was emblematic of your superior skill set. So let's just pause on that CFA. What does it give you, in your opinion?
Well, I think the CFA shows that you've got the commitment to actually deliver and actually get through the exams. And I remember one firm, I was, for some reason, asked to look after 3 people who were doing the CFA exam and sit down with them once a week and help and answer their questions. And I was horrified because they were in tears. And that was just the boys. They really were. They found it a terrible struggle. It was a terrible commitment. And you've got to be really, really dedicated to get through the exams. But what good is that? It's useful in that you could demonstrate that you've got the commitment to see something through. But I don't believe that it's really a genuine financial analysis qualification in the way that a modern today an analyst needs to be able to cope with really quite complex accounting, often for very many of the big quoted companies. The accounting's pretty hard. The CFA doesn't equip you with that. I don't know why people haven't come up with something better. Maybe it's just lethargy. The CFA, I think, could do a lot more to develop that qualification and make it more intensive. But maybe it's just too difficult. It's a difficult qualification to get, and maybe they don't want to make it any more difficult. I don't really know.
But if we reduced it in its essence, is that whilst it's regarded, revered, it's emblematic of extremely serious hard work. I have a nephew who has it and know how hard he worked to go through the whole 3 stages. And yet what you're saying, so I like you to express it, is that if you put Apple's report and accounts in front of somebody typically with a CFA, where would they hit the roadblock?
They'd hit the roadblock probably in the cash flow statement. And I've done this. I've done exactly that. And look, they get 70% of the way there, I'm sure, without any problem. And they understand the theory extremely well. But as you know, Simon, the theory in investing, it really doesn't help you that much. So I've just this afternoon been going through my valuation content with these people who've got 2 years experience. And the first section of the valuation is about the theory. And I said, you know what? We don't need to do this because you've done it at university. It's not actually going to help you. The capital asset pricing model, all these issues around the application of beta. Warren Buffett expressed it, as ever, better than I ever could. If you've got a stock that has a huge drop in share price, its volatility goes up, its beta goes up, and therefore it appears to be more expensive and it appears to be riskier. But nothing could be less risky than a stock that's fallen by 30 or 40%. So The irony is that the beta is taking you to exactly the wrong result, exactly the wrong answer. And if you're going to operate practically in stock markets, you need to have a practical framework. You need a practical framework for valuation. You need a practical framework for accounting. And the CFA, I think, is excellent at the theory, but I don't think it helps people as much as it could in the practical side of it.
We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. We're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is sponsored by Bordeaux Index, and I'd like to briefly share a few details about Live Trade, their market-leading fine wine trading platform. Did you know over the last 5 years, some of the most prudent investments weren't in gold or stocks, crypto or fixed income? They were in bottles. Live Trade is the place to start buying and investing in fine wine, with the platform showing instant and transparent bid and offer quotes on the world's most sought-after wines. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Burgundy, Italy, and other top wine regions. With 24/7 updated two-way pricing and instant liquidity, there are no hidden fees or membership costs. While the finest case of Bordeaux can be aged for up to 50 years, it can now be sold in an instant with Live Trade. Discover more at bordeauxindex.com/livetrade. So let's talk, and I know you come today from helping analysts at a very well-respected hedge fund, and that's one of your great strengths is that there aren't many of you with that experience and insight and expertise, and I certainly could have done with that course what I could do with it now. However, let's just talk about the sell side and the buy side. So traditionally, the sell side, the UBSs, the Redburns, the Bernsteins conducted in detail research and you paid or you took their research. And then you had the buy side, the likes of the investment managers, Fidelity, Wellington and Schroders. So you had research being conducted on both sides of the camp. Has the power and the quality shifted away from the sell side and towards the buy side?
Absolutely. All three of those names you mentioned are clients of mine, and the people they've got are fantastic. They really are high quality. In our day, you got paid more on the sell side than you did on the buy side, and therefore you attracted a different caliber of person. Today, the buy side is much better paid than the sell side. And the sell side's been incredibly juniorized, just phenomenal. When I started in the city, there was a guy called Ron Barone, who's the number one gas analyst in the US. He followed 16 stocks. Do you know how many stocks he follows today? He's at the same firm. So the firm that he was with was taken over by UBS. I don't know if he's still working, but I saw him. I had lunch with him in New York 5 or 6 years ago. And I said, Ron, how many stocks do you follow? He said, 96. Now, he has a team of really capable analysts and associates helping him. And he's obviously a lot more experienced than he was all that time ago. But the fact is that the sell side role has been juniorized, and MiFID II has been a massive culprit in this. Now, you can argue about the attractions or otherwise of MiFID II, but the impact it's had is that there's less money to pay for sell side research, and therefore there's less money to pay the analysts. That's what it comes down to. There's fewer analysts and they're less well paid. And it was encapsulated very well by a friend of mine who was at the time the head of research at a bulge bracket firm. And he said, you know what happens, Steve, is my best analysts get poached by the big hedge funds. And they come in and they give in their notice. And I know that I can't keep them because I just don't have the budget to keep them. And I go, oh dear, you know, what am I going to do now? Because I've lost that skill set. And I look around, and I look at their junior and I think, oh yeah, okay. So I put the junior in the seat and I know I've got that saving in my budget. And the problem is the budget every year goes down. And that's the problem.
Got it. Now, this is particularly important, is it not? Because we've had the tailwind of super cheap money. Interest rates have risen. There is a day of reckoning, some would argue, that is upon us and unfolding. So perhaps, and I don't want to answer your question, it has not been as important in the last 20 years to be able to do that forensic accounting.
Well, certainly in the last 10 years, it hasn't mattered a jot. And I was laughing when I first started doing all this stuff and I was interviewed by Real Vision, And they were asking me, well, how important is all this? This was 2019. I said, well, you don't want to listen to me because the last thing I'll do is tell you to buy a Tesla or one of these racy stocks because I'm worried about the balance sheet. I'm worried about the accounting. I'm worried about the capital expenditure. And none of that matters right now because that's not what's driving markets. But I would contend that we're entering a different phase. And we've had interest rates go up a lot, whether they stay where they are, whether they come back. Interest is now a factor again. And I think that balance sheets are going to be even more important, particularly as you get the running off of the maturities. So companies have been very effective at terming out their debt very cheaply. We were talking about Apple. I was very surprised Apple actually raised a 0% bond. But that bond isn't going to last forever. And when it's replaced, they're going to have to pay interest on it. And this is going to be a much more important feature of analysis going forward. And if you think that we're in an inflationary environment, and in the past, inflation has tended to erode companies' margins, then you've got a double whammy because you've got a lower operating margin and potentially higher interest to service. So I think this whole concept of balance sheet analysis is going to be fundamental to successful investing going forward. Not that many successful investors haven't been looking at balance sheets, but if you've been looking at balance sheets, it probably held back your performance in the last 10 years.
So there's a quotation here from Sebastian Lyon, who's the founder and CIO of Troy Asset Management. We both know him. And he said that our investment team very much enjoyed the forensic accounting course they did with you. And looking at corporate collapses such as Carillion and Patisserie Valerie, he says, it's our job to avoid the portfolio torpedoes at all costs, which come from poor accounting. And it's particularly important to be reminded of this. And behind the balance sheet, planted essential seeds for our fund managers. So clearly you've had praise from a number of quarters. If I can ask you to give us an example of one of those companies that survived and then suddenly all of this was exposed. And what was it that you were seeing and what was it that would typically be the red flags that would alert you?
Well, Patisserie Valerie, which you just mentioned, is a really good example. And I use this a lot, especially when I go into universities to try and explain what I do to younger people who've got an interest in all this. And Patisserie Valerie is a great example because Patisserie Valerie was reporting margins which were higher than those of Starbucks. And the beauty of this is you don't actually need to be a sophisticated forensic accountant. For a lot of these fraudulent stocks, all you need to use is your common sense. So if you think about Starbucks, it makes predominantly coffee. You look at Patisserie Valerie, it used to make cakes. And you just need to look at a cake. And if you see the picture on their website of a cake, it's got a huge amount of labor in it. And it's got a load of cream in it. It goes off. Coffee is one of the highest margin products in the world. You can't find a higher margin product. And a lot of Starbucks sales are to take away. None of Patisserie Valerie's sales were to take away. Just think about this. So you've got a product that's much more complicated to produce. You've got one product that's being taken away. If you look at the cost profile of a typical UK restaurant, 35 to 40% of its sales are labor cost. Rent, 12% sales. So just in those two items, you've got 50% of your sales. If you think that Starbucks was selling most of its product to take away, and Patisserie Valerie was selling most of its product in-house, it couldn't possibly have higher margins or any margins anywhere near Starbucks. Now, that's a very good example of just using your common sense and asking, does this look right? Would have told you immediately that Patisserie Valerie, there was something fundamentally wrong.
And whilst you explain it like that and it's obvious, clearly it wasn't obvious to a lot, hence the surprise and the collapse. Does it get much more difficult when you get other situations? And I don't know, so I'm just going to pull this one out, Wirecard, which wrong-footed lots of analysts. I am going to say that one of somebody we both know, and I'm invested with him, Chris Dale of Kintbury Capital, was short Wirecard for some time, but lots of so-called expert investors missed it.
Wirecard, I guess you could have missed it until the point that Dan started publishing in the FT. And as soon as Dan started publishing in the FT, it was perfectly obvious because the FT is not going to write a front page article about a stock being a fraud unless they've got quite a lot of evidence. So that should have led you to go back and question everything in Wirecard's accounts. And the telltale signal in Wirecard was very obvious. It started off, it had €1 billion in cash, and it raised a 500 million euro bond and a 750 million euro bond. And when it went bust, it had 3 billion in cash in the balance sheet. And you just ask yourself, why would it need that money? There was one reason it needed the money, was that the cash wasn't real. And it's surprising, I think, to many people. And it surprises me. The one thing that the auditors should be able to check very, very, very easily is the cash balance. And why many companies, and this is not a rare occurrence, many frauds, the cash balance the auditors should have checked turns out to be fake. And in the case of Wirecard, I think anybody that held the stock after all the evidence, and the FT went on for a long, long time, anybody that held that stock surely should have asked themselves, is this real?
So we had Scott Bessent, Soros's former CIO and the founder of Key Square Capital, on the show a few weeks ago, and he said about risk, and I thought it just encapsulated thinking about risk really well. He said, my definition is both probability and severity, i.e. it's one thing getting it wrong, it's another thing being wiped out. And Patrizio Valeri and Wirecard are examples. Just to turn this round, though, when it comes to evaluating companies on the long side, those good companies that you want to own for a long time, how do you think your forensic accounting helps?
Well, I think it really helps a lot because almost every company I look at is engaged in some form of earnings management, right up to the largest companies in the world, the Apples and the Microsoft. They are engaged in exactly the same practice. And it's one of these inflationary things. It's like grade inflation in exams. You see a CFO of another company engaged in flattering its earnings, and you think, well, if I don't do the same thing, I'm going to suffer and my shareholders are going to suffer. So you feel an obligation to push the envelope and make your earnings look better than they really are. And maybe Berkshire Hathaway is one exception that I could think of that they aren't engaged in that, and probably the reverse. But just one instance in the case of Apple, they've had about 170, 180 basis points of margin benefit from going from on one policy being extremely conservative to now being extremely aggressive. That's just one instance that I've spotted. And every company that I look at is engaged in earnings management to some degree. And it's funny that you should mention Sebastian, because when I originally met Sebastian, I said, oh, you guys might be interested in my forensic accounting course. He said, well, come in and see my head of research. And I went in to see her, lovely lady. And she said, we only invest in quality companies. I'm not sure that this is for us. And I said, well, that's perfectly reasonable. Why don't I sign an NDA and you give me your 180 stock universe and I'll tell you how many of those stocks appear in my course. And the course has got between 150 and 200 examples of real life companies cheating. And there were several of those companies. And they were very, very shocked that I had found companies that they considered to be high quality. And the companies are perceived as high quality and they've got high quality businesses. It's just that their earnings aren't as high quality as the businesses. And I think that this is really, really fundamental to valuation, because what you don't want to do is pay up a high multiple for a perceived high quality business whose earnings are being goosed. And that is happening a lot today.
And the other element that my suspicion is going to come back to haunt investors is the tax rates. And a lot of these firms, of course, have managed down their tax rates. And then the extrapolations on valuation come from tax rates that may be very hard to sustain in a world that all the regulators and authorities are looking to raise more revenue.
Well, when I started this course in 2018, it was before this OECD 15% global tax rate came in. And I used two tweets, one from Bernie Sanders and one from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And they'd both highlighted that if you paid an Amazon Prime membership, you paid more to Amazon than Amazon paid in US taxes that year. And I said, look, this is not going to endure. And if you think about where we are in the world, every government in the world is up to its neck in debt post-COVID. So at some point, especially if interest rates are going up, I've forgotten how much the number is in the US, 14 trillion of potential interest payments in a few years. The problem you've got is that you've got a huge amount of debt and interest rates are higher. So you're going to need to either generate some growth or some more tax revenue. And you don't want to take it off people that vote. So corporations have had a pretty easy time when it comes to tax. So I think that their time is going to come.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause.
The Money Maze podcast is sponsored by IFM Investors, a global institutional asset manager whose purpose is to invest, protect, and grow the long-term retirement savings of working people. Owned by pension funds and inspired by their members, they invest in what matters. As a responsible investor, IFM actively engages with their portfolio companies on issues they care about, with the aim of improving net performance whilst minimizing risk. They manage investments across infrastructure, debt, listed equities, and private equity assets. To learn more, tap the link in the episode description below.
Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. Tax rates and giving workers a larger share of the pie than has happened in the last 20 years may make the landscape much more tricky. Enough of my bearish interpretations. However, let's talk about what you develop, because here at the Money Maze podcast, one recurring feature that Will Campion and I are and have been asked about a lot is what financial training and teaching we would advise. And in fact, we even had a dinner here for some very interesting previous podcast guests, and we discussed the problem in the UK of inward equity capital. But as an aside note, it was observed that understanding of risk was poorly processed in the UK, and that in fact, risk appetite often was not what it should be for a culture that wants to encourage correct risk-taking. Now, most people in the investment business, I think we would both agree on, are not sufficiently financially literate, and even the training within those investment firms differs, shall we say, and the CFA doesn't answer all of the solutions. So over the last 18 months, we've been looking and trying to understand you and your course. So that's one of the reasons that we're talking today. And we put this collaboration together because you're behind the balance sheet online learning course, Will, be available from today on our website, moneymazepodcast.com/learn. And for Money Maze Podcast listeners who go on, there's a 10% discount, and we hope it helps you become smarter and avoid the losers as well as identifying the winners. But can you just talk a little bit about what somebody thinking about financial training, taking your course, should expect to discover?
The course that we're collaborating on is a course which covers every aspect of financial analysis. So it covers not just going through the financial statements, but it's a really in-depth, detailed walkthrough of a real-life example, a company that was being quite aggressive in its accounting, but looked to be very clean. So you go through that module, and at the end of that module, you should have a pretty good understanding of some of the nuances, some of the tricks of the trade. So I actually went through this yesterday with the people that I've been training today. And these people are very smart, 2 years experience at other institutions. They were amazed when they went through this material. Now, I went through it with them quickly in person. When you do it online, the additional advantage you've got, there's some exercises. So you download a spreadsheet and it gives you some questions. You complete that exercise and then you download an answer sheet. So you can actually get practice and get help. And I think online education is looked down on by some people because they think, oh, well, I'd be much better off in a classroom. But this is fantastic material because you get the chance to practice on your own, in your own time. I've got one student who completed this course by sitting down every lunchtime on his mobile phone or on his laptop. So you can do it in your own time, at your own pace, at your own leisure. The financial statement is the start of it. We then go through, how do you find a stock idea? Where'd you look? How'd you find it? And then how do you decide, is it a good idea or not? So how do you test the hypothesis? How do you decide, is this a quality business or is this something that I should leave? We then go through all the ins and outs of valuation. We even cover the theory, even though I don't believe in the theory, but we cover the theory just to make it complete. And we go through all the practical elements of valuation. How do you think about a PE? What drives a PE? What do you look at in addition to a PE? Because I don't believe that you just look at earnings number. I believe you need to look at the cash flow. So we look at how do you calculate an enterprise value? We go through all these basic building blocks of valuation. We then put it all together by saying, okay, so you found a stock idea. You've decided it's a good company. You've valued it. You decided it's the right price. What do you do next? So we go through, how do you pull the trigger? So how do you refine the timing of entry into the position? Then how do you build a portfolio? How do you build a robust portfolio which is diversified, not just sectorally and geographically, but against all sorts of robustness, against outside measures? We then go through, how do you manage that portfolio? How do you monitor it? So this could be a person looking to look after their own personal portfolio, or you could be an analyst at a fund, or you could even be a portfolio manager. I've got loads of portfolio managers who, quite surprisingly, that they've actually done this course to try and improve their skills. And we go through, how do you monitor the outside macro? How do you look at macro events? We've got a whole team of 3, 4, 5 economists, I've forgotten how many, explaining how they go about looking at the macro world. So you've got some idea of how the macro and the micro relate to each other. And we've got a section in ESG. And then to wrap it all up, we've got 2 really long, extensive, detailed case studies. One where I follow a company which from over a 3 or 4 year period, we go through every set of results. We've got research that was produced at the time of those results. That stock went from £4 to £18 over that period. So you can see this is how a real life company can make you money. And then we've got a short idea where the stock completely imploded, went down, I think probably 80%. And we track that from the original note, short idea down to where it eventually ended up. And there's loads of testimonials on the website. People who have done this course and done the CFA said it was miles better than the CFA. We've got somebody who did a course at Columbia University, I've got an online course, which is a multiple of the price. They said this was miles better than the Columbia. It's a really high quality endeavor.
Well, that's really well explained. So how many hours would you think somebody signing up should be allocating?
Honestly, I don't know, because everybody's got a different pace of learning. Everybody's got a different level of experience. If you wanted to do the entire course, what I suggest is you do every Monday night, you sit down for 2 hours, and at the end of the year, you have covered all the ground. There's a lot of, however, additional reading. I've got some quite left field views in certain things, like I don't believe in valuation theory. So I don't believe that I should voice my views on the innocent student. So yes, I do voice my views on the innocent student, but I give them the counter argument. So wherever I've got a slightly left of field perspective, I make sure that I've got the conventional argument in a PDF or some reading. And there's a whole load of podcasts. You make a few appearances, a whole load of video content, because not everybody likes to just read. And there's a whole load of homework where you get, here's one of Warren Buffett's letters. Here's the things that you can take away from this. So this is external to the course, but additional stuff if you want to get involved. But 2 hours a week for a year or a bit more. And if you've got some experience, it will be considerably less time.
Got it. So that's extremely clear. I think Will, my partner, said that he described it as a life jacket for the years to come ahead. And I think the inverse of that also could be the engine for outperformance on the long side. So, and I know you've written the book, The Smart Money Method, and we'll be publishing and featuring, you know, a number of these on the website. And we really hope, because financial education is so important, it's so important for the next generation, as well as the current incumbents who are charged with the responsibility of managing money, that this can be a really useful tool. I've got 5 quickfire questions that I'm going to ask you. The long short universe, do you think it's failed to deliver?
I don't necessarily agree with that perspective. I mean, people compare the long short returns with Wall Street performance that's shot the lights out. Obviously, if you're long short, you're not going to do as well as a long only in a bull market.
So who's the best investor or the most impressive investor you've met in your career and why?
Oh, that is a very unfair question because I've got all these clients and I would have to name
I would have to name
one of those clients. Obviously, Buffett and Munger are champions and nobody will ever come close to their record. And I would have loved to meet somebody like Druckenmiller or Soros because just the magic when you listen to them. But there's a huge number of people that I've got an enormous amount of respect for. I think one of the wonderful things about the podcasting game is that you get the opportunity to not to meet them, but at least to listen to them. And I think that's been fantastic.
We were lucky enough to have Scott Bessent, who worked with Druckenmiller and said that Druckenmiller was the single most impressive investor that he had ever met. And then when asked about Soros' skill set, he said the best thing Soros ever did was to hire Druckenmiller. So I thought that was rather funny. And then Ray Dalio's talked about his approach. And you're absolutely right. It's a great window, the podcasting world, on being able to listen to expertise. I don't want to give anything away from your course, but is there a stock today that you would want to avoid?
Oh, no, I'm not going to name a stock. These questions are terrible. I hate them. I think, honestly, anything that's got debt today, you want to be very wary of because people have grown accustomed to easy markets. And you and I have grown up with markets where debt was really an issue. And I think people have overlooked that. So I would just, it's not answering your question, but anything with debt is something that you want to be very wary of.
That was Will Campion's question, not mine. Anyway, so I think that my final question is, and you alluded to it, but what's happened at the accounting firm that has allowed some of these corporates to get away with bad behavior?
It's a really good question. I wish I knew the answer. One of the big four is a client of mine, and I have trained 500 of their partners in how to spot fraud. So my main thing is a forensic accounting course for investors, but I also do this fraud detection course. And I was really surprised that not all the big four wanted to do this course. And there is still time, there's still hope. But I think they have really taken their eye off the ball. And it was quite interesting, the reactions to my course with them. So I did 2 2-hour presentations for 250 people. And it was quite interesting that I was just looking at it from a completely different perspective. I think the problem with the accounting profession is the partner in charge of an audit often has done no job in the real life other than being an accountant and being an audit partner. And today, the world's very much more complicated. And I think you do need to look at things through a different lens. And I think it's just a lot easier for me to spot these things because I go in with a different mindset and a different approach. So I think that the accountants need to get my training.
Got it. So Steve, thank you. You are one of a very small cohort of people who can get behind the balance sheet. And I think we agree that this is more likely than not to be a testing investment climate for some time. And being able to do that forensic accounting may make a big difference to your investment returns. And whether you're a private equity firm or a pension fund or a hedge fund or an individual, this could be invaluable. So we hope that this course that you've been offering and that we're collaborating on will be a gateway for lots of people to become better informed. So thank you for being here, and we look forward to working with you.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.